Hello, I'm Nadia Frontier, and welcome to this bonus episode of Ice World. Normally on this podcast, I'm speaking to people who are currently in Antarctica at Rothera Research Station. But today, I'm here in Cambridge for a chat with the director of the British Antarctic Survey, Professor Dame Jane Francis. Jane is a legend in the polar science world as a scientist and paleobotanist and as a leader. Jane, how many times have you been to Antarctica?
Gosh, as a scientist, I went to the Arctic and the Antarctic in field camps on about 15 expeditions. But since I've been director of BASS, I've been to Antarctica more or less every year to take down important stakeholders, funders and the like. So I've lost count. I've stopped counting. But I love every time I go down.
So Jane, you got a polar medal in 2002. That's an award for outstanding contribution to British polar research. And in 2013, you became the first woman to head up the British Antarctic Survey. How was that? Did you encounter any barriers being a woman? We'll start off with International Women's Day.
Do you know, through my career, I've had very few times when I've really felt that I was sort of oppressed as a woman or held back as a woman. There are one or two. People didn't really expect a woman to take over as director of BASS. I have to say, they did expect a man. And so actually in the first week or two that I was here in the building, and I remember one evening when I was unpacking all my boxes and tidying up my new office with a security guard who was helping me, which was lovely. But at the end of the evening, I got asked if I was the director's new secretary.
By the security guard?
Yes. So I've had actually more comments like that while I've been director of BASS than I have throughout my career, simply because I don't think that, you know, the stereotypical director of BASS is thought to be a man. So even with academics, sometimes they've asked me, what do I do? And I say, well, I'm the director of BASS. And they say, yes, but who is the director of BASS?
You are joking. Still today, that happens.
Not so much today. I think today people know who I am, so that doesn't happen so much.
But still, you're appointed within the 21st century, so...
Absolutely.
What you're talking about are comments that are still disbelief that a woman could head such a prestigious institution. So you've really changed perception.
Well, I hope so, yes, and I hope any woman could do it if they really wanted to, yes.
What would you say your job involves?
Every day is different, and every day I have a diary, and it never goes according to the diary most days. So I do things inside of BASS. So I work with my fantastic team of directors that work with me to actually, you know, help make sure that BASS is working properly. We kind of look after the really high level things like safety and risk and finances and make sure that BASS survives. But a lot of my job is also outward facing, working with the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. So that's really important because that's part of our remit to be the UK presence in Antarctica. Working with NERC, the Research Council, because another part of our remit is to do world-class science. I work with a lot of other Antarctic nations because Antarctica, being such a huge continent with such huge science questions to ask, is really important that we work together with other nations. So international collaboration is important. That means I network massively. Recently, I went to a meeting with a lot of other polar people, and we were planning big new science campaigns for the next 10 years. Last night, I was at a reception in the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office and was talking to the science minister, inviting him to visit our station in Svalbard, talking to a whole range of ambassadors with which we want to collaborate. So it's really multitasking and very, very varied. And that's what I really like about it.
Sounds intense and completely different to an academic career as well. Very different. We'll move on to that. Do you think people care about what's going on in the polls? Do you get that impression when you're at all these big outward-facing meetings and speaking to extremely important politicians and leaders?
I think they do now. I would say about 5 years ago, people, you know, were interested in climate change, but they didn't realise how much impact the polar regions has on the planet. But actually now, you know, we've seen it, you know, scientists in BASS, we've seen that things have really escalated in the last couple of years. There's really changes that we can see and we know that are happening. And I think the polls now have become more imprinted in people's minds. I think even businesses recognise that the melting ice and the impact on sea level and the extreme weather is a threat to businesses and to people living on the coast, to supply chains, to the whole planet, the way the planet operates. And so I think now the polar regions have become a lot more focused in people's minds.
I guess the next step is getting politicians to actually do something about it.
Absolutely.
That's the first bit. Now everyone's caring. Okay, let's talk about science. So your specialism is paleoclimatology and paleobotany. What exactly does that entail?
I'm a geologist, so I've studied rocks. But also in those rocks, there are fossil plants, and there are also other kinds of signals of what the climate was like in the past millions of years ago. So I started my sort of geological research on the Dorset Coast, believe it or not, on fossil forests on the Dorset Coast. That was of Jurassic age, so there were dinosaurs and trees living on the Jurassic Coast, and it had a climate much like Morocco millions of years ago. And that kind of expertise studying fossil forests and climate is what has taken me through my career and taken me around the world. When I started, there weren't that many people looking at the geological side of fossil forests as opposed to the botanical side. And so I was invited on expeditions to the Arctic with the Canadians. I went to Australia to work on fossils and climate in Central Australia, which was quite an epic. I've worked in Antarctica with the Americans and New Zealanders. I came back from Australia to the UK, to the University of Leeds, where my research focused on working on rocks and fossils and climates in the Antarctic Peninsula, supported by BASS.
So is that the first time that you got in with BASS when you came back to the UK and worked with Leeds?
Actually, before that, I had a year working in BASS just on a very short contract in the late 80s, I think it was, before I went to Australia. I think it was money that came to BASS after the Falklands War. And so there were a group of us that had short contracts. And that gave me a taste of what was in the collections and what was possible to work on in Antarctica.
So you were in Cambridge working on Antarctic fossils?
Yes, just for 1 year. I never, ever thought that I would end up working in Antarctica as a major career. In fact, I never in my life thought I would be working in the polar regions, certainly not when I was young or doing my PhD. It's almost still quite a surprise to me that I'm doing this. But it is a fantastic place to work to do science. And it's so great to make all these new discoveries in Antarctica in the Arctic.
It absolutely is. And it wasn't on the curriculum at the time that you were at school. Like today, there's Antarctica and the Arctic, a big programs, schools have the opportunity to design flags that people can take to the poles. Climate change is discussed, but you went to school in the 1970s and graduated in 1978 from the University of Southampton. From what I've read from your interviews in the past, science, climate, geology wasn't really on the agenda in that way.
Well, certainly when I was at school, nobody ever thought of warming climates, actually. That's more of a thing that was discovered in the 80s onwards. So when I was at school, we learnt about ice ages and the patterns of waxing and waning ice ages. And actually, I did study geology, but mostly as rocks, certainly not as past climates. So when I was even at university, studied, say, the last ice age and Quaternary ice age, but not much further back than that. So the modern climate change that we see is something that came in probably when I returned to Leeds, or when I was in Australia and when I returned to Leeds. And then I taught paleoclimatology to many geology students, and I taught them about climate warming, and I taught them about rising sea levels and the impact on the UK of rising sea levels and melting ice sheets. So it had happened in the geological past, and so I taught about that and then about what was going to happen in the future. That was a long time ago. So it was in the 80s and 90s, and that was when climate change wasn't quite so dramatic in Antarctica at that time.
But it was starting to come on the agenda in the curriculum.
Yes.
So then how did you get to Antarctica?
My first trip to Antarctica actually was with BASS. I was based in Australia at the time. Mike Thompson, who was chief geologist at the time, took the Bisco, which was one of the old BASS ships, to Antarctica around the Antarctic Peninsula with a whole ship full of paleontologists and geologists and structural geologists, a whole bunch of people that he had collected together to have a look at these islands on the east of the Antarctic Peninsula to try and understand what the geology was and what was there. Prior to that, to go around these islands, you had to go on skidoo because the channels around these islands were frozen. There's sea ice there all the time. And actually, when we went, which was about 1989, was the first time the channels were unfrozen and the ship, although there was still some sea ice there, and the ship almost did get stuck in the sea ice in the summer. But we managed to sail around these islands, and we used the ship as a floating hotel, a floating camp, and we put groups of scientists on these different islands. And we really, for the first time, looked at what the geology was like and collected some of the most interesting fossils from there. And from that time, all the rocks that we've collected and the fossils we've collected have contributed to my research and PhD projects and to the work that has happened at Bass.
That is absolutely fascinating. So I can't believe that in the past, they used to access James Ross Island and Seymour Island via the peninsula using skidoos. And you were the first year on the Biscoe to access these islands via ship.
Yes, I think it was around that time. I certainly know that in the past, before we went down, that a lot of the channels were covered with sea ice all through the summer. So people were able to skidoo all the way across from Rothera all the way across to the islands in the east. So when we went down on this special expedition in 1989 in the Biscoe, it was actually the last year of the Biscoe. So when we got to the island, which was, I think it was about January, and we hit the sea ice there, we couldn't get down the channel any further. So because it was the last year of the Biscoe, the captain decided we would go for it. Otherwise, we would, I mean, we even talked about having to go home if we couldn't get through around these islands. So he sort of really pushed the ship into the ice and then reversed again and pushed a bit further. In fact, we threw spoonfuls of cocoa powder over onto the ice to mark where we'd got to each time until actually we got into the ice and then the ice closed around us a little bit. So we retreated very quickly and went somewhere else and waited for the ice to melt during the summer.
How technology has evolved today on ships. Don't need to use cocoa as markers anymore. Probably can use GPS. Okay, so after, let's say 10 years after, almost 10 years after you graduated, you published your first paper, and that was looking at wood fossils from 145 to 2.6 million years ago, roughly. There were trees in Antarctica. That's what you found, and that was one of the first pieces of research that you published.
So the first paper I published was about the forests in Dorset. So those are Jurassic, about 150 million year old fossil forests. So I published a few papers about my PhD and then and other rocks that I'd worked on and then about the work in Australia. But I then started publishing papers about the fossils from Antarctica, particularly fossil wood.
I've heard that it's black. Can you describe to me what a fossilised bit of wood looks like?
The wood inside is black when you break it open, or some of it is actually brown still. But actually, when you see a piece of fossil wood lying on the surface, it just looks like a piece of wood. But it has been petrified, often by either silica or calcite, and so it is rock. And over millions of years, what's happened is the wood, particularly in this situation in the east side of the peninsula, forests were growing on the Antarctic Peninsula when it was a volcanic arc. So it's a bit like the Andes with forests on them. And the trees then were knocked down, blown down, floated out into the ocean to the east. It then became waterlogged and then sank into the mud at the bottom of the ocean. And over millions of years, they soaked up this mineral solution that was going through the ocean sediments. And then that gradually crystallised and petrified the wood.
For the listeners, what does petrified mean?
It means it turned to stone, basically, turned to stone. But it does look like a piece of wood. So when you go to Seymour Island or one of, in fact, many, many places in Antarctica, the rocks were formed on land, say like rivers. If you go to the Transantarctic Mountains, where I've worked with the Americans or with the New Zealanders, you can see rocks sequences that were formed on land, sometimes as rivers that deposited sediment in riverbeds and river channels. And there are huge fossil logs in that rock sequence, which represent tree trunks that were carried down the rivers and then buried in the sand and in the rivers and then petrified again.
And then uplifted to form mountain ranges.
Yeah, and they're there in the rock sequence.
And was that during the time when Antarctica was in its pole position that these forests came about and then started to decompose and were then fossilised?
So the ones on Seymour Island, the ones on around the Antarctic Peninsula, they were indeed about 100 million years ago. The Antarctic continent moved, due to tectonic movements, moved over the pole, and it has been sitting there ever since. That's what's really important about the fossil plants that come from the east side of the peninsula, Seymour Island, James Ross Island. They are plants that were growing in Antarctica 100 million years ago, or a bit younger, when they went over the pole. And in fact, there are also very famous fossil forests on Alexander Island, which is just south of Rothera. And again, you can find fossil trees still in their position of growth in the rock sequence.
Okay, what did fossil wood show you?
Fossil wood is really interesting, and at the time I was started it, not many people had actually worked on fossil wood and applied the techniques of paleodendrochronology. Well, not chronology, dendroclimatology.
So that's counting the tree rings?
Yeah,
so we didn't, fossils?
Not specifically counting the tree rings, but looking at the state of the tree rings. So using the same techniques that scientists work today on modern tree rings, but applying them to fossil tree rings. So we use the same techniques. So we did count the width of the rings, which tell us a bit about the growth rates. We looked at the cell sizes, how they varied across a year, and that told us a little bit about the seasonality. We could work out from the type of wood what kind of climate the tree might have grown under, but we could see whether the trees suffered intense drought, whether they were had plenty of water. Sometimes you could tell whether they're at the edge of the forest, whether they had been attacked by insects. There's a huge history captured in a piece of fossil wood.
So it's like you can reconstruct past climates by looking at different variables within the space of tree rings.
So some of the very early explorers in Antarctica had found fossil wood on Antarctica. They hadn't necessarily worked on it, but they had found fossil wood. Because a piece of wood that's petrified is, you know, it's really durable, and it, if it's lying on the surface, you know, you can see it and it looks like wood. And people were picking it up, even early whalers and people like that. So
it had been described, but yes, then actually analysed chemically. Is that work one of the first investigations into trying to reconstruct past climates using these fossils?
When I was working on the forests in Dorset, there was a paleobotanist called Tim Jefferson who was working in Bass at the same time. He was doing his PhD at the same time as I was. I was looking at Jurassic wood in Dorset and he was looking at Cretaceous wood in Antarctica. And so we were working on very similar things. So it was quite unusual for two people to be working in the UK on very similar topics. So we often exchanged ideas.
That's amazing. And then there's a project currently, well, that have just come off Seymour Island at the moment. So you were giving them quite a lot of advice into their expedition.
Seymour Island has a special place in my heart because I have spent many seasons there in the mud of Seymour Island. But it's just amazing fossil paradise. There isn't an ice cap on Seymour Island. So the rocks are 100% exposed. The rocks are not lithified. So they're not, you can't hit them with a hammer. It's really strange. The island or the rocks in that area haven't undergone high temperature or high pressure. So they've not been sort of lithified into hard rock. They're still like piles of silt and sand. And the only hard bit of rock is about half a metre down where it's been frozen as permafrost. But the surface is quite dusty. So when the fierce Antarctic winds blow, they blow all this silt away. And what's left actually are the fossils, both sort of marine fossils and fossil plants that are encased in harder sort of nodules of rock, and they're lying on the surface.
So there's just fossils scattered everywhere.
There it is. It's amazing. It really is a quite incredible place to work.
Playground, isn't it? How did you feel when this project just went back to Seymour Island? Did you feel a little bit jealous?
Yes, I'd love to go there again. But I'm not sure that I'd want to get stuck in the mud there. I've been stuck in the mud on Seymour Island many, many times, because what happens is there's no ice cap, but there are obviously snowbanks. And in the summer, the snowbanks melt and there's plenty of water around. And that just turns the mud into this great big thick soupy mess, which if you stand in, you know, it sucks your Wellington boots off you and it just coats you from, you know, shoulders to toes with mud, which then scrapes itself off all over the tent and everything. I'm sure it's the only place in Antarctica where you get ridiculously muddy to do field work.
You can't exactly shower either.
No.
How do you find that transition from, obviously, you've done field works many, many years ago, but how are you finding this transition that you've been living for quite a long time of going from being in the field, living in tents, collecting fossils, doing field work, a lot of manual labour, to now this very important public-facing figure?
Well, I do miss field work, I have to say. And one of the things I really miss is spending 2 or 3 months in Antarctica in a field tent remotely away from the rest of the world. And I'm one of the old breed who liked to think that when I went to Antarctica, I was closing off and shutting down. So I didn't try and maintain contact with the rest of the world. When I first went to Antarctica was the time when our contact with, say, family at home was 100 words telex. I think it was each month. We would radio back to, say, Rothera and speak the words, say, to my mother over the radio. They would then write them down and send a telex back to the UK and then write them and send a letter back to my mother. And she would do the same coming back to me. You had to be very careful what you put in those 100 words.
Definitely can't say anything private if you have to read it out over the radio. You're one of the first people to camp in Antarctica as a woman?
No, I went to Antarctica for the first time on that expedition to James Ross Island on the Biscoe. Mm. And at that time, Bass didn't take women into field camps in the field. So there were women and the women geologists working for Bass at that time, but they tended to stay on the ship, so they didn't go into tents. Although we did, there were several women with me on that expedition, but we weren't Bass employees. But it was soon after that, I think it was 1991 or 93, that women geologists then, or women scientists then, camped in the field camps just like the men.
That was quite new that women were allowed to camp in the field. Did you encounter any barriers?
So my first experience really of going to Antarctica was actually with other nations and camping with other nations. So with the Americans and with the New Zealanders. And then yeah. I was just one of the party.
Because they've been doing that since the 70s. Yes, there's quite absolutely. A lag from when
yes. Yes.
The Americans were taking women into the field compared yeah. to the British Antarctic Survey. Okay, so one of the things that I hear people saying a lot about British Antarctic Survey is that the equality and work culture have moved on massively since you've been in charge. Have you got any prominent examples that you could share with us?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's changed hugely. I mean, it was when I was at Leeds University looking from the outside into Bass, it was very much male dominated. Lots of senior males at the top of the institution, not so many women working in Bass in science, I don't think. So the numbers have increased massively. And I know the diversity in Bass is hugely different than it was 10 years ago. You know, in my top team, there's me and four other directors. And I like to tell people that we do have a problem in diversity in our top team, because in that team, yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us, we only have one male. So we need to increase the diversity, I guess, to get a balance.
Shifting.
Yes.
Do you feel proud of being responsible for instigating and bringing some of this change into Bass?
Yeah,
I
think it's much more healthier, but it's not just me. It's, you know, there's a whole raft of people that have helped do that, both change the numbers physically, but also change the attitude, which has been brilliant. Men and women have changed the attitude, which has been fantastic.
Absolutely. And a massive focus on EDI and
yes,
much more inclusive workspace.
Yeah, we've still got more work to do to increase diversity further.
Absolutely. I think it's more prominent on stations where that ratio, especially during winter and teams, the ratio between male and female is still very much male biased. Mm. So many things have changed in the last 10 years whilst you've been director. Halley has opened in 2013. There's been a new research ship, the Sir David Attenborough, and now there's modernisation projects at Rotherham. There's net zero targets, and there's lots of new technology that's expanding, such as science, autonomous vehicles and AI. How do you feel about all of that?
Well, it's been fantastic, isn't it? It's been really exciting. I mean, I went to Antarctica this year on the ship, on the Sir David Attenborough, and it was amazing. It really was amazing. And this is me who used to go to Antarctica on the Navy ship, HMS Endurance, and was always seasick. And I just remember being on the ship as just a nightmare of lying drugged up in my cabin. But the Sir David Attenborough, just incredible. It's so stable, and it was just a pleasure to be on it. So it was an amazing trip. But, you know, we've been able to work with some really good support in NERC and to receive the funding that's enabled us to modernise BASS. It's a long journey. We've still got more to go. But I think we're turning what was a fairly, I want to say old-fashioned, but it was for that time. It is, you know, some bits of it are still old-fashioned, but we need to modernise and bring up to where we are now. But I think we're on an interesting journey. And somebody said to me recently that we're actually at a cusp from fairly standard ways of working to a really different, new, innovative style with autonomous vehicles, you know, very conscious of our carbon footprint and working in much more modern style, using a lot more satellite observations with better communication because of satellite communication. So we can send data back better, quicker, faster, more people can work on it. I think we are changing the way that we will be doing polar science, and other nations are as well. So we're part of a big change, I think.
Keeping pace with that change. During the last 10 years of your career, is there a particular moment that sticks out for you?
I think the ship launch was quite amazing. And we had several launches of the ship, actually. I remember when the first piece of steel was put on the floor of the workshed in Birkenhead. And of course, we then launched the ship and named it. But between that, we launched the hull of the ship. In this huge, big building, the hull of the ship was built before the top was put on. And it filled this massive building. So it had to be launched out of the shed and then the top could be put on. I think it was one summer's day, and it was a very hot day. The hull was launched and it was due to be pushed outside and then slip down a slipway into the river, slowly and elegantly, with a few people on top. And David Attenborough and I were due to press the button and see it released. But it was actually hilariously funny because it was an extremely hot day and sort of tallow, waxy grease had been put on these wooden poles. So the ship was going to slip down and, of course, it was all melting. So when David Attenborough and I pressed the button, the ship absolutely shot down this ramp into the water and then shot down the river. And the tugboats that were due to catch it and then take it up the river shot back in surprise. It was
no way.
It was quite a moment. It was quite a moment.
Must have made some serious bow waves as a result.
We thought those poor tugs were going to go under when the hull went down. That was a great day.
What's it like, Jane, when you take non-science people to the poles? How do you manage their expectations and how do you explain the work that's being done to a non-science audience?
It's quite an easy job, actually, because as soon as they see icebergs, as soon as they see the amazing landscape that there is in both polar regions, you don't need to do much else. They're just blown away, to be honest. But actually, it's really interesting to then describe to them, well, the kind of research that we do on, say, the ice, on the atmosphere in Antarctica, on the marine creatures that live in the ocean, to explain to them how the ocean is so important to what's happening to the climate in both regions. So they begin to understand in a little bit more detail. And that's really satisfying, so that they come away with a bigger picture. But I think it's that first view of an iceberg, like everybody, the first time you see an iceberg, it's just amazing. And the first time they see the polar landscape, it's just so incredible, and it's so unlike anything else you can see in the rest of the world. It just blows them away.
So just to conclude, Jane, have you got any final closing messages of hope for the future, especially the younger generation that have got much better access to knowledge about climate change and especially what's happening in the poles?
Yes, I think it's really important that we carry on doing the science and really understands what's happening. We know the bigger picture, but we still need the detail because we need to be able to tell the rest of the world how the polar regions are affecting everybody that lives around the world, not just what's happening in the poles, but how it's affecting everybody. And then we also need to inform the policymakers how it's affecting how our planet functions. I've been to some meetings recently with business people who really now are interested in how the polar regions are going to affect the whole of business and life in the more populated areas, because the polar regions represent a massive risk. Sea levels rising, the weather's becoming more erratic. And so I think now many more people need to know what's happening in the polar regions. It's a job for us all to make sure that we talk about what we do, to engage with policymakers and try and make sure that we get our world back into a better balance in future.
Absolutely. Great closing words. Thank you. Jane Francis from the British Antarctic Survey. I really enjoyed my chat with Jane, and it was super exciting because I've heard a lot about this recent Seymour Island project. Four people have just been upon the island in a pyramid tent collecting a range of fossil samples dealing with that mud. One of them's my office mate and one of them's my partner. So it was really cool to talk to Jane about her past experiences. If you enjoyed this podcast, please do subscribe and think about leaving a review. It's really important that we get the message out there so people can understand what it's like to work in the polar regions, and maybe even this might inspire them to apply. You've been listening to the Ice World podcast with me, Nadia Frontier. Join us next time for another episode of what it's like to winter in Antarctica.